Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloh, and thanks for listening today. Hey, let's talk about climate. Yes, it may be cold outside this time of year, and the weather was pretty nasty back east a few weeks ago, but the planet is indisputably warming, and scientists are quite sure that human activity is mostly responsible. Despite what politicians or your Uncle Steve might think, things are happening at an accelerating rate. While it's hard to link single weather events to climate change, it's also hard not to wonder about this past year's extreme weather. The terrible fire season California just endured was a product of years of drought, followed by one unusually wet year. The denuded hillsides in Southern California were then hit by a massive downpour of rain. One of the predictions of climate models is that our warming atmosphere holds more moisture. Rainfall, when it happens, tends to be more extreme. The resulting catastrophic debris flow took lives and ruined dozens of homes. So with all this new normal in mind, let's talk to two widely respected climate scientists, Josh Willis from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena and NBC Miami TV meteorologist John Morales. First up, oceanographer and climate expert Josh Willis. He won a Presidential Early Career Award from Barack Obama in 2009, and since then, he's been a regular contributor to our show. Josh joined us via Skype from his home in Southern California. Josh, welcome back to Blue Dot.
It's so good to be here, Dave. I mean here, but here, you know.
You know, it's always good to be here wherever you are.
Right, indeed.
So let's talk weather and climate, shall we, Josh?
Absolutely.
Because you're an actual climate scientist. Now, the first thing I want to talk to you about is, you know, I just watched CNN. And of course, anytime some extreme weather event happens, they have to give it a stupid name.
Right.
This one is being called the bomb cyclone, which is, I think bomb is part of, it's a meteorological term. It's in there. And somebody probably just, you know, heard that and went, oh, that sounds great. Let's use that.
Right. Yeah, I don't know the origin of the bomb term, but it seems weirdly appropriate for the politics of the day, I guess.
Yes. But let's talk about, you know, because, of course, the president had to famously tweet in about, you know, that this is proof that there's no global warming because it's cold. And we run into this, it seems like, just constantly this confusion between, you know, somebody experiencing super cold, frigid weather in winter, oh, surprise, and climate, which is gradually warming. Could you just discuss that briefly for us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's so much confusion as it is deliberately misleading people. You know, look, the planet's warming up. There's no doubt about it. The whole planet is heating up. Sea levels are rising, ice sheets are melting. This is not in debate. We can measure it. We've been measuring it for decades, and it gets warmer and warmer every year. But of course, there's weather that happens on top of that. I mean, it's not like every day is hotter than the last day in every location everywhere on the planet. We still have seasons. It still gets warm and cold every year. This is part of the natural cycle of climates changing. And of course, we still have weather, huge storms that pummel us out of the Arctic like this one. You know, in Southern California, where I live, sometimes we have El Niños or atmospheric river events that dump huge amounts of water on us. So weather is part of life. It always has been. It always will be. But to mislead people that it's a sign there's no climate change is just dishonest.
Well, and you throw, you know, politics on that, on top of it all. I so don't understand why somewhere along the line, the Republican Party in particular, and conservatives, that's a strange term to use when you're talking about conservation, they somehow attach themselves to this anti-climate change point of view, and they're just stuck on it. For example, we have a representative here for my area who, when asked about climate change, says, yes, I believe in climate change. There's four seasons.
Right. Sure. I mean, it's a common enough problem. I mean, we have folks like that here in Southern California, too, who just want to deny that the planet is being radically reshaped by human activity. but it is. You know, sea levels are rising around the globe, and they've gone up inches. They go up about an inch per decade, something like that. Gone up over a foot in the last 100 or 150 years. And if you stop to think about that for a second, the oceans are two-thirds of the planet. So two-thirds of the planet are rising. That means we're literally reshaping the entire globe. And you can't just brush that off like, oh, seasons, or, oh, you know, it can't possibly be us. It's definitely us, and we're definitely looking at a warmer and more melty world.
Yes, I recently interviewed Jeff Goodell, who's the author of The Water Will Come, which is about sea level rise. And in his book, he discussed about the Norfolk Naval Base, where they're having subsidence on top of sea level rise. And the military commanders there, they see what's happening. They know politically they can't call it that. So they just, you know, they come up with some weird acronym for it, or some weird moniker that means we need to build the piers higher. But what I was startled by was the commander of the base said that base could become unusable within 2 decades, which is a really short period of time. And when you consider that's the, you know, most powerful naval base that the United States has, one of the most powerful ones in the world, that's alarming.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, navies are uniquely threatened by sea level rise. By definition, they have to be by the sea. And it's our ability to adapt to rising sea levels depends on the terrain where the ocean meets the sea, and whether that land is also sinking and so forth. But in the long run, sea levels are going to rise around the world along almost every coastline by a large amount before the end of this century, and we're going to have to deal with it. We may be able to avoid the 6 or 10 feet of sea level rise if we act really quickly, but there'll be a foot or two, or probably even 3 feet, almost no matter what we do.
Let's talk about your work. In particular, you study the glaciers on Greenland, right?
That's right. So I'm the lead scientist for a mission called Oceans Melting Greenland, or OMG for short. And we're flying airplanes around Greenland, trying to measure the oceans and how the oceans are changing, and also measure the ice right at the edge of the ice sheet where it's flowing into the sea. So we measure both of these things every year, and then we look at how the two are changing and try and answer the question, how much are the oceans responsible for eating away the ice around the edges of the ice sheet? So it's a 5-year-long program. We're about halfway through. And we're definitely seeing that the oceans are playing a really important role in how fast glaciers are retreating and how fast the Greenland ice sheet is reacting to the warming planet.
How often do you actually go out into the field to like observe the glaciers?
Well, we have two campaigns every year. I don't always go on every one. Some of them, the ice campaign, for example, we fly around very high at very high altitude along a very fixed set of routes to measure all the glaciers right at the edges with a radar. But there's also an ocean survey in the spring. And that one really requires a scientist to be there because a lot of times the place you want to drop your ocean probe is covered with ice, or it's too foggy to see and make sure you're not dropping a probe out of the sky onto a fisherman or a whale or something like that. So we go out twice a year. Usually I go on the ocean survey in the spring, but sometimes I go on the ice one in the ocean ones in the fall and the ice ones in the spring.
That would be bad to see a headline that said NASA kills fishermen with probe.
Yes, it would. You know, with all things NASA, safety is really the top priority. So the pilots who fly these planes are very, very capable and always most interested in everyone's safety above all. But we got some really great science done this past October when we were in when we were in Greenland, flying around on a C-130 out of Virginia.
Have you personally seen, over the time you've been studying this, a dramatic change in those ice sheets, you know, visually, where you can say, wow, this just didn't look like that a few years ago?
Well, it's a little early to see a year-to-year change in a single glacier, but what you can see is where the glaciers a decade or two decades ago had been scouring along the sides of these canyons, and they leave behind sort of a bathtub ring where when the glacier is retreating. And you can see these kind of bathtub rings that are signs of glacier retreat all the way around Greenland. They're almost uniform everywhere.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. Time for a short break, but when we get back, we'll continue our conversation with NASA oceanographer and climate scientist Josh Willis. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return to our conversation with NASA climate scientist, oceanographer Josh Willis from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. When you get together with climate scientists at a conference or whatever, what's it like to be in a room full of people that are all climate scientists? What kind of discussions do you have? Because it must be kind of nice for a change to not have to deal with people who are questioning what you do and that kind of thing. What's it like to be in a room full of climate scientists?
Well, we're always arguing about something, Dave. It's just not whether global warming is happening. But scientists are skeptics by our very nature. And one of the most important things we do is scrutinize and be skeptics of each other's work. So very often, big meetings full of climate scientists involve people trying to measure things or draw conclusions, and other folks saying, well, you can't really draw that conclusion. So we're a skeptical, surly bunch, I think, just by our nature. But it's invigorating, though. It's exciting because when you find a result, or you discover something that stands up to that kind of scrutiny, then there's sort of a feeling of accomplishment, like, wow, I discovered something about the world that nobody knew before. And that's what makes science fun. It's what makes it exciting. And climate science is no different. In some ways, it's the most exciting time to be a climate scientist, because we're doing this massive, uncontrolled experiment with our whole planet. And that makes it, that means there's something to measure. There's really something there to, there's a signal there that we're all trying to understand and predict. We're scientists, so we often try to divorce ourselves from the emotional impact of these things. But of course, that's always there too. And so there's always this sort of feeling of, wow, I can't believe the Earth is changing in such a radical way.
Can you give us an example of a moment you had like that, where you accomplished that feeling of, wow, I just discovered something that nobody knew before?
Well, yeah. We were just analyzing this year's data, in fact, and we were starting to look at some different glaciers around Greenland and comparing them between 2016 and 2017. And as you expect, most of them are shrinking and retreating. But there was one glacier, one really important glacier called Jakobshavn. This is one of the most famous glaciers in the world, really. It's a huge ice stream. It's been retreating for over 100 years, and it vomits up an incredible amount of icebergs. It's one of the fastest flowing glaciers anywhere in the world. And what we saw between 2016 and 2017 was that it didn't retreat. It actually advanced a little bit and thickened, unlike most of the glaciers in other places around Greenland. And when we looked closely at the water temperatures just offshore from this huge glacier, it appears that they have cooled. So it's not a complete analysis yet. It's just sort of the first sign, but it suggests that the ocean, when it warms or cools due to natural cycles, is having a strong control on how much the ice is retreating. So much so that if it cools significantly over a year or two, then you might see an advance of certain glaciers, even these huge glaciers that have been retreating like this for a long period of time. So this was some work that we presented in New Orleans at the big Geophysical Union meeting this year, and we're excited to kind of scrutinize it a little more and write it up soon.
How difficult is it to tease out the difference between those natural cycles affecting something like you just described from what we're contributing?
Well, that's really the whole ball game. That's a lot of what we try to do as climate scientists. And it's always a challenge over a short period of time. But if you wait long enough, it's easy. You know, over 100 years, you can see changes that are just completely obvious. And it also depends what you're looking at. Things like global sea level rise, we can measure that incredibly accurately from space, and almost every year, sea level is higher than it was the year before. Every once in a while, there's a big El Nino or something, and it might take 2 years to see the clear sea level rise signal. But it depends a little bit on what you're looking at. Things that sort of average over the whole globe, like sea level rise, have a much clearer signal of the human impact on the climate. But local things, the seawater off the coast of Greenland, for example, has a whole lot of other stuff going on. The weather in Washington, D.C., right, of course, has influences from all kinds of local factors and things. And so teasing it out is always sort of that's the fun part for us climate scientists. But we've gotten really good at it, and there's a whole lot of signals that are perfectly obvious that the human footprint of climate change is there.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. You and I talked about the Flame Challenge from the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. And this year, the Flame Challenge is, and for those of you out there who don't know what it is, it's a challenge to the world scientists to answer a basic question. And the answer is supposed to be understandable by 11-year-olds. And those are the people who judge the entries. And they're usually videos and essays, but the videos are the most interesting ones. So this year's question, of course, is what is climate? So can you explain to my 11-year-old mind what your explanation for that would be?
Yeah, absolutely. And for what it's worth, I'm planning to submit a video to the Flame Challenge. But I think the simple way to explain climate is it's sort of a whole bunch of weather mashed together. You know, we think of the weather as the temperature, and whether it's raining outside, whether it's hot or cold, whether it's humid or dry. And climate is really an average over all those things for a period of time. So, for example, here in Southern California, we have a very moderate climate, whether it's summer or winter or spring or fall. It's usually within 10 degrees of 70. and that's true for a lot of Southern California because the ocean is a big factor in our local climate. In other places, like on the East Coast, you have a huge swing between summer and winter. And of course, the climate changes where you are all across the world. We have things like rainforests in the tropics, where you almost never see snow and it's hot and humid and rainy all the time. We have deserts where there's almost no rain, and we have temperate forests all throughout the United States. So the climate is really the weather that you expect on a regular basis. And what's happening to our planet is the weather that we expect on a regular basis is getting warmer all over the planet, little by little, in almost every corner of the Earth. We're heating up the globe, and that's a factor in the everyday weather. But of course, the weather can take you on a wild ride even without global warming.
And it seems to me that recently we've been having more and more extreme kinds of weather events, like the heat and drought in the West. For example, here on the West Coast, we're under this ridiculously resilient high pressure ridge, as they call it, that is blocking our storms and kicking us back into a drought pattern, or thus far it's been that way. In December, we got hardly any, no precipitation at all here. And then on the East Coast, you're seeing, you know, these incredible cold storms. And the hurricanes we had. It just seems like the extreme weather events are happening more and more often. But whenever the question comes up, is this due to climate change? The standard answer is always, well, we can't ever pin one certain weather event to climate change. Are we ever going to get to a point where scientists will start to say, yes, you know, we're starting to see that climate change is definitely affecting the weather?
Well, yeah, and we're already there, really. You know, it's the problem isn't so much whether we can measure it. It's sort of how we talk about it. You know, for example, like a big recent one was the flooding in the hurricane flooding
in Harvey in Texas,
and before that Sandy in New York. The flooding wasn't, you know, it was going to flood no matter what, but it was 10% worse, let's say, because of higher sea levels, and maybe another 10% worse because the warmer atmosphere can pick up more water and dump it over the land. So all these things are having a small impact. They're making extreme events worse. So that's already happening. And there's examples of that all over the globe. It's hard, you know, oftentimes you hear that answer when we're in the midst of one of these. And it takes a little while for the scientist to sit down and go, okay, you know, how much of this storm was really caused by global warming and how much would it have happened already? It's not an easy question to answer. And so far, it's not the biggest impact. You wouldn't, you know, write a story about the flooding in Houston and blame the billions and billions of dollars worth of damage all on global warming. There's a lot more to it. But it is playing a role already. And the likelihood of some kinds of extreme events like severe flooding is increasing. Just for the reason I said, the atmosphere is warmer. It can pick up more water and dump it more quickly in a different place. And we're beginning to see the impacts of that. But scientists are conservative by nature. You know, we don't like to overstep what we can say. And that's one of the reasons why we're conservative in communicating about it.
That's a good answer.
Thank you.
You know, because you're a federally employed scientist, you work for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA in Pasadena, and I'm sure you enjoy living in Southern California. But a lot of scientists were, you know, beckoned by the president of France to come to France to study climate change, since it seemed to be under threat here in the United States. Do you know anybody that's taken them up on that?
I don't. You know, that news story circulated among a lot of my colleagues quickly. But I don't know anybody who's bailed out yet. I think for the moment, at least in NASA, where, you know, I haven't been fired that I'm aware of. I mean, I haven't been into work yet this morning, but you know, we're still carrying on the research that we've been doing for quite a while, despite rhetoric or stories about big changes in the government. You know, I think some of the other agencies have been more affected than NASA has so far. We'll kind of have to wait and see. But you know, if this whole scientist thing doesn't work out for me, I can always fall back on being an actor and a comedian.
You can call out Climate Elvis.
Exactly. Yes. Climate Elvis.
Can you tell our listeners who Climate Elvis is?
You bet. Climate Elvis is my alter ego and my handle on Reddit, actually. He's going to be singing the song about explaining what climate is in my flame challenge video. So I've been working on my Elvis impersonation. Oh, of course I can. Anything for you, Dave. A little less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark, a little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and baby, mitigate me. Mitigation, baby. That's not part of the song. That's just for fun, but you recognize that one.
I'm all, yes. I used to watch Las Vegas a lot on TV.
There you go.
There, I love James Caan on that show.
Absolutely.
Before we let you go, one last thing. What do you do all day? If you were like, you know, to tell your a little kid, somebody says, "What do? You're a climate scientist." What to describe that to an 11-year-old? What's a typical or a kind of day like for a climate scientist? What do you do all day?
Well, the most important thing that I do as a climate scientist is look at data. You know, we collect all kinds of data about the climate from satellites, from little floats that drift around in the ocean, from tide gauges, from weather stations. And all this is telling us a story about what's happening to our Earth. And my job as a climate scientist is to figure out what that story is and tell it to everyone else. And so on a typical day, a lot of what I do is look at this data on my computer. I download it. I do calculations with it. But mostly what I try to do is figure out what it's telling me and what that means. And it's exciting. It's a lot of fun, actually, because for a little while, when you figure something out, you're the only one that knows that in the whole world. And that's a lot of fun.
Well, one last thing. There's always one last thing, it seems. You do a lot of public outreach using your skills as a comedian and a performer and making videos and doing shows like this, which I really appreciate for our audience. So thank you. But, you know, part of it is trying to educate people. Have you ever had the experience of successfully taking someone who's very skeptical about climate change and climate science? Have you ever gotten somebody like that to turn around and admit that, you know, probably they didn't know what they were talking about and maybe you're right?
Well, yeah, my dad. when I first started studying global warming and climate change, you know, he was definitely skeptical of the whole thing. You know, I have an advantage because he kind of has to believe me since I'm his son. But I think, you know, there's an important lesson there. And the lesson is that if we really do want to convince people, that are inclined not to believe that global warming is happening, then you have to relate to them, in a close way. You have to reach out to them and really try and get on the same page. Try and not, you know, you can stand up in a big room full of people and shout that someone's wrong. But that really doesn't convince people who are inclined not to believe you to begin with. So I think it's building personal relationships is the answer to really convincing people who are sort of stubbornly resistant to this idea.
So Josh Willis, climate scientist, changing one mind at a time.
Exactly.
And I'm just for the record, I wished I had been as successful with my dad, because it's one of those things where when that comes up, it's like, hey, Dad, how about the Dodgers? How do you think they'll be this year?
It's not easy. And I think part of it, too, is to kind of understand that it's not necessarily about the facts. And as a scientist, that's something that is, how can it not be about the facts? Of course, it's about the facts. But oftentimes the disagreement is about a worldview or about something that's more deeply ingrained than just a bunch of evidence. And until you figure out what that is and address that, then it's always a roadblock. There's been some research done that says that if you start by talking about solutions to climate change, then people are much more willing to accept that it's true. And that doesn't have anything to do with evidence. It just has to do with how people approach the problem. And until we start to kind of learn from that, it's going to be an uphill climb.
Well, Josh, thanks for making that uphill climb every day.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. It's what I do.
And thank you so much for joining us on Blue Dot. It's always a pleasure having you on the show. And welcome to the all-new Blue Dot, by the way.
Thank you. I love being here, Dave. It's always a pleasure. And congrats on the new show.
Josh Willis, NASA climate scientist and oceanographer from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Happy 2018 and all good things to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
It's time for another short break, but when we come back, we'll talk to John Rosales, meteorologist from NBC TV in Miami. Welcome back to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. Now we're going to listen to a conversation I had with John Morales. John's the chief meteorologist for NBC TV in Miami and one of the few, the elite TV meteorologists elected to be a fellow with the American Meteorological Society. He kindly joined us between TV newscasts from Miami, Florida. John Morales, welcome to Blue Dot. Hey, I'd like to start by just finding a little bit about you. Tell us about your journey. How did you become a television meteorologist?
Yeah, well, how I became a meteorologist is probably the pretty standard answer that you get from most of us. Generally, sometime in our preteen to teen years, we start to like weather, and perhaps there's one big event that we're all impacted by. And that's pretty much the standard story you hear from all of us, and we start to look into the career, and eventually we end up in it. In my particular case, during my summers in college, I would spend the summers working as an assistant at the National Weather Service in San Juan, Puerto Rico, where I grew up. And that's a U.S. National Weather Service office. And eventually that led to a civil service career. And as a public servant there, I spent 7 years in different National Weather Service offices, not just in the Caribbean, but here in the U.S. But there was a big hurricane in 1989 in Puerto Rico, Hurricane Hugo. And, you know, media tended to gravitate towards me simply because I had a little bit more communication ability than I guess your average scientist. That gave me a lot of exposure, and some folks on TV started to knock on the door, and that's how I ended up on TV, and I started that career in the early 90s.
And you've been at the same station ever since?
Oh, no. I have been in the same city ever since, 27 years now as a chief meteorologist in Miami, but 18 of those years in the Spanish language, and I did that for Univision for a dozen years, and 6 years then at Telemundo. But the last nine or so here at the NBC-owned and operated station in Miami.
Wow. And tell us a bit about your experience. Your mother is in Puerto Rico, right?
Yes, that's correct. I just saw her over a New Year's weekend. And gosh, my mom at age 85, so strong, resilient, organized, well-organized for this terrible catastrophe down there in Puerto Rico, Hurricane Maria. In Puerto Rico, homes are built generally not just with cinder block walls, but poured concrete on rebar roofs. And I'd say, from middle class and up, everybody has those type of homes, and she's got one of those too. So I wasn't too concerned about her home being blown away, but I was concerned about the aftermath. But she prepared very well, had a water reservoir, had a generator. Had taken out cash, done all the standard things that you do before a hurricane. And, well, she spent 3 months plus 1 day without power, did not accept my offer to bring her to Miami during that time, spent the whole time down there in Puerto Rico, and nevertheless persisted and got through it. And I saw her in good spirits and strong when I visited her just a few days back.
Wow. Nevertheless, she persisted.
That's right. That's correct. Applies to many things.
That's amazing. Well, I wish her the very best. I'm glad she's safe and her power's back on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a difficult slog down there. Still half the island without power. I visited a community. I'll just put this in here parenthetically. I visited the Humacao community in eastern Puerto Rico. That is very, very close to where the I made landfall. And there is still just a huge amount of destruction over there. People don't have power. But the folks in Puerto Rico, I mean, they are in as good spirits as you can possibly imagine for people that have been through this major catastrophe. And they're plowing forward and trying to find ways to make ends meet and hoping for a better future.
Well, you came to my attention with the issue going on with the very cold weather. And it's cold in Florida, too, isn't it?
No, it sure is. We had a couple of nights here where some of the suburbs of Miami and Fort Lauderdale have dipped into the 30s. No records, but certainly a very cold, cold snap.
Wow. And, of course, the very famous tweet now by the president, Donald Trump, about we need global warming, but because of this cold weather. But to be fair, he's not the only person that makes that mistake. And I'd like you to address that, what's going on with these very cold temperatures on the East Coast as compared to climate change.
Right. Let me start off also by saying, it's partly human nature. People just, look at what's going on now and have to deal with what's going on at the present. And sometimes, have a difficult time seeing the forest through the trees. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you combine that with, oftentimes a lack of scientific literacy in this country. And that really seems to be headed in the wrong direction, if anything, over the last several years. And, people just don't seem to maybe remember their middle school earth science classes and the difference between weather and climate. And that was the main point when I countered or pushed back against the president's tweet a few days back. I did record something that aired that very night. at my newscast here in Miami, where I'm basically trying to make folks realize that the reason it's cold is because of the current ongoing weather pattern. But it's only cold in North America. The rest of the world, compared to average during this particular time, is running mild to downright warm. And if you look at the poles as compared to average, they are hot. Again, not hot temperature-wise. It's generally very cold in the poles. But compared to the average readings, it is most definitely much hotter than it should normally be. Now, climate, on the other hand, of course, is the long-term average. When you look at climatology, you're talking about long-term averages of what the weather has been in the past. So climate is what you expect when you move to a certain city, and you may or may not bring a parka, or you may or may not bring flip-flops based on the climate of that city. But that doesn't mean that once you're there, once you've moved to that city, you may not have the need for a sweater, in the case of Miami, due to this ongoing weather change that we've had. Or, most of the year, you do get to use your flip-flops if you happen to own them here in South Florida. So there's a difference between weather and climate. Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you get.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your role as a television meteorologist addressing the issue of climate change, which is still, for some reason, controversial in this country. When you're like in a room with a bunch of TV weather people, is the consensus that climate change is real and they, you know, agree with that?
Well, it is now, but I will tell you that 10 years ago, that was not the case. And the American Meteorological Society had to step up their efforts to educate broadcast meteorologists in regards to the state of the science of climate change. I myself co-authored an op-ed in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, which is sent out to its 14,000 members or so every month. And that was done way back in the year 2007 when we realized that, gosh, I mean, compared to the scientific consensus, broadcast meteorologists were lagging far behind. And apparently were allowing their personal, political, religious, and other types of views interfere with their understanding of the science, and therefore they were having a difficult time communicating the state of the science to their audience. Now, the way the AMS acted on this was they set up several workshops at each one of our conferences during the last several years, and now we've reached a point where the broadcast meteorologists are most definitely on board with the scientific consensus. I think they're much more educated on the subject. Broadcast meteorologists in this country are generally degreed meteorologists, but not everybody has a physics and calculus-based degree like in my particular case. I mean, I have a full-fledged degree in atmospheric science, but not all of us do. So sometimes that can be a little bit more challenging for the group that perhaps has not been through a more rigorous scientific training process than some of us have.
Have you ever had an experience, perhaps with a television meteorologist or anybody, where you've been able to convert them from skepticism to accepting the fact that climate change is real? Because that's not an easy thing to do.
It is not. It is not an easy thing to do. And it's not something that you can do generally in the course of a 20 or 30 minute conversation. I have not had that experience in a 20 or 30 minute conversation, but I have had experiences with grassroots organizations like the one I'm involved here in Miami called the Clio Institute. And you can look that up, clioinstitute.org. The Clio Institute provides training for anyone that wants to walk in to these basic climate science 101 courses that they put on over the course of a weekend, and sometimes even put on for different municipalities here in South Florida. So, for example, the city of Fort Lauderdale had all of their employees go through this training so that everybody would understand the science of climate change, because after all, in Fort Lauderdale, known as the Venice of America, this is very much needed knowledge, as you might imagine, from these public servants in a city that is very threatened by sea level rise. So you put people through a little bit longer exposure to the science and make them understand why things are trending the way they are, and how little influence natural forcing is having right now, because we'd be pretty much neutral if left up to natural forcing, or if anything, cooling slightly, but instead we're warming rapidly. And it helps people understand that, you know, this is man-made, and that we have to find ways to mitigate and adapt.
Well, and in Florida, in particular, sea level rise is a very important issue. Recently, I had the good fortune to interview Jeff Goodell about his book, The Water Will Come, and Miami was a very big focus of the book.
Right, and as it should be, because our king tides are becoming deeper and more widespread with every year that passes. The king tide is the time of the year, generally in the fall, when we've got the gravitational forces of the sun, moon, and earth such that we get higher tides during that time of the year. But the problem is that while we've had the king tide be, a minor nuisance for a couple of isolated pockets of communities here in South Florida, say 50, 40 years ago, now in the last 10, 15 years, it's not just one or two communities. Many areas of Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach, Miami proper, and other cities are having the sunny day floods of saltwater inundation come up to their front doors, impede tourists from making it to the front steps of their hotel, having roads have to be shut down because cars can't make it through the salt water, et cetera. So for us, it's an existential issue down the road. And sooner than that, I can tell you it's going to be a big economic issue, too, because there's going to come a point where all this buildup along the coast is going to be uninsurable. And that is going to probably lead to big time drops in property values. The tax base is going to be affected for these cities. And, that's probably going to happen this century, mid-century already. So it's a crisis that's up and coming. I think South Floridians are very much aware that this is a problem. Certainly here in South Florida, our political leaders are not in denial, and they are trying to find ways to adapt to this with a de facto carbon tax, which takes many shapes and forms in the way of bond issues to be able to finance some of the raising of roads and seawalls and other things that they're trying to put in to keep the salt water from coming.
Well, what do you think is the root cause of so many politicians in on the East Coast in particular that are still resistant to the fact that this is happening and it's starting to happen now, and they still seem to want to, blame it on natural cycles? What is the root cause of this?
Boy, that is a very difficult question. I would tell you of that it's got a lot to do with, who's funding the campaigns, what entities are funding campaigns. And it's almost a feedback loop because, first of all, some of these politicians are being financed by some of the very entities that put on this deliberate misinformation campaign that kept Americans confused and misinformed regarding the state of the science of climate change for decades. As you know, and this is a long subject, we can talk about it, but, the cable channels and journalists in general would easily find a climate scientist that could talk about this, the global warming and the climate change that we're seeing. But journalists felt compelled in their zeal to provide balance, because, of course, that's their whole mantra, right? I mean, that's how journalists are trained. They're trained to provide balance, but they don't understand the scientific process. And in the scientific process, you eliminate answers, right? And you're always skeptical, you're always checking, you're always reobserving and making sure that everything continues to fall in line with your hypothesis and eventual theory. But you come to one conclusion, then there's no two sides to the story. So gravity is gravity, and smoking causes cancer, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, right? Well, the same applies to climate change. But journalists would find these non-climate scientists who happen to have PhDs, sounded important and educated and were good communicators, and they'd sit them there on the talking head stations and have them debate a climate scientist. And because we have this climate illiteracy issue in this country, I think many folks at home would look at these debates and say, well, you know, I think the other guy's right.
There's two sides to the story.
Exactly. Yeah. And there really aren't. So at the end of the day, a lot of confused Americans that feed back into this issue where you have the politicians denying it, the people at home believing the denial and finding reasons to support that denial. So therefore, the politician feels emboldened to continue in the denial. And it's just a feedback loop that's very, very detrimental to what we need to get done.
So we're about out of time, but before I let you go, is there one question or misperception real quick you can tell us about, like a question you get sick of being asked?
Well, I mean, I think the one that we all get is, you know, if climate change and global warming are real, why is it cold right now? And again, like I said at the onset of this segment, you know, I think it's human nature. Sometimes you have to give a little bit of leeway to human nature. Because, you know, I mean, there's so many of us in the world and we all need to understand each other better. So, yes, it's an annoying question to get from my perspective as a weather and climate communicator. So I try to treat them as gently as possible and try to make them see the difference between weather and climate and how climate really is warming across the globe.
Well, I can't think of a better person to do that than John Morales from NBC TV in Miami. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on Blue Dot.
It was a great conversation. Thank you very much.
And thanks to our guests, Josh Willis from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and John Morales from NBC TV's Miami affiliate, Channel 6. Watch them next time you're headed to South Beach. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for Ira Flatow on Science Friday. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. Listen to this and past episodes on mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Schloem. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and co-produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.